Chairman, our next witnesses are Mr. Britt Hume, writer, and Mr. Joel Gore, counsel representing the American Civil Liberties Union.
Senator Ervin, members of the committee, my name is Joel Gora. I'm staff counsel of the American Civil Liberties Union. I appear here today with Mr. Britt Hume, a working journalist who, on the basis of his experiences, will present information to the committee. We have both prepared statements which we've submitted, and we would hope that those statements would be part of the record of the proceedings. Each of us will make a few brief comments, and then we'll be glad and delighted to answer.
Well, the written statements which you submitted to the committee will be printed in full in the body of the record immediately after your other testimony.
Thank you, Senator. Three years ago, when these issues first received public attention, 3 years ago this month, perhaps even this week in February of 1970, the ACLU became involved in this problem, and we urged two simple propositions. First, that the primary purpose of the First Amendment is to guarantee an informed public, an informed citizenry. And second, that the members of the press can't discharge that constitutional purpose unless they're able in some significant ways to protect their sources. Happily, the first premise has become axiomatic now, and I think no matter what position people take on this issue, everyone starts out from the understanding that the First Amendment is there for the benefit not of the journalists, not to protect them, but to protect the public. The second proposition, whether in order to do that they require protection of their sources and of their information, is what these hearings are all about. The Supreme Court narrow majority, concluded that such protection was not requisite. In my written statement, I've suggested some reasons why we think that conclusion was wrong, but I think the most important thing was that the court was simply insensitive to the process by which news gathering goes forward. These hearings are remedying that defect by hearing from working journalists and hearing their descriptions of how the process works. Let me, if I might, just respond to what I understand to be some of the questions that are concerning the committee. First and most important, whether there's a need for legislation. I think that's fairly clear. Since the Supreme Court's decision last June, there have been a number of reporters facing jail, a number of reporters thrown in jail. Many of those episodes have been documented in a magazine article by Mr. Hume in the New York Times on December 17th of 1972, and with the Senator's permission, I'd like this article to be made part of our presentation as well. The troublesome thing about these subpoenas and these...
You can find the committee with a copy of the article while we'll put the article in the record.
Certainly shall, Senator. I think the most troublesome thing about these subpoenas is the kinds of stories that the journalists who are facing incarceration or other kind of punishments have been covering. They've been covering stories about municipal corruption. They've been covering stories about the conditions in various kinds of institutions, penal, hospital, juvenile, and so forth. They've been developing information that makes it possible for the public to be better informed and to govern itself. And the kind of journalists who require statutory protection or judicial protection are really the best journalists we have. They're the journalists who illuminate the issues of our day. So I think that there's no doubt legislation is needed. Should it reach beyond federal proceedings? I think there's congressional power to do that. Senator Eagleton adverted to the premises of that power. I think the other issue is whether it's desirable to exercise that power. I think it probably is. Many of the journalists who have been subpoenaed were subpoenaed in states where there was state protection, but the judicial proceedings involved gave a narrow interpretation to those state statutes. I think the symbolism alone of a strong federal statute will remedy a lot of that problem. And the other thing I would suggest is that if there's only federal protection in federal proceedings, in those states that don't have state statutes, you're going to have the possibility of a version of the old silver platter doctrine. The official who can't ask the reporter questions picks up the phone and calls the state official who can and causes the state official to initiate an investigation, subpoena the reporter, and so forth. It used to come up in terms of the admission of evidence into either federal or state proceedings. I think it's a real problem, which argues for protection in all forms of proceeding, federal and state. And finally, if the bill does cover state proceedings, it should make clear that where there's a state law that goes further, that gives more protection, that law is not preempted by the federal statute. The other issue that the committee is wondering about is who should be covered. Victor Navasky, an investigative reporter, has suggested that writers of nonfiction books should be covered since they're really just slow journalists. The point is that the process is the same. The investigative process, whether it culminates in a column, in a daily paper, an article, in a magazine, or a nonfiction-type book, the process must be protected. Similarly, we would hope that the bills that define who a newsman is don't restrict it so narrowly that only the traditional establishment press is protected. Two other points that I'd like to make. In terms of the mechanisms for invoking this, I agree with Senator Tunney's observations that simply making it burdensome for whoever wants to subpoena a reporter to do so will accomplish much of what we're here to urge you to do. Burdensome in terms of the showing that must be made, and burdensome, I think, in terms of requiring a court order before any kind of disclosure can be required. I think that alone would maybe cut out the majority of the subpoenas. It's a very casual thing to issue a subpoena, and I think if it were made a not casual thing, they would not be frivolously issued. Finally, and I guess this is the most difficult question, it's certainly the one that's provoked the most controversy, what kind of protection should be afforded? I don't know that the matter can be stated as simply as whether the privilege should be absolute or qualified. In a sense, even an absolute bill, which requires that the information be obtained in the course of functioning as a journalist, is a qualified bill. Well, everyone accepts that. So those absolute bills have a qualification, but the qualification isn't germane to the issue. As I understand it, when we're talking about qualifying a refusal to provide information, we're talking about a showing or a finding that a particular interest is more important than the system of news gathering and the free flow of information to the public. I can think of very few interests which are that important. I know that Senator Ervin is concerned with reporters who are aware of information about criminal activity. But some of the best investigative reporting we have comes as a result of reporters being given access to that information. I think the trade-off is worth it. I think that having that information disseminated to the public so that the political processes can be informed by that information, in most instances, is more important than incarcerating a particular criminal. Let me give you an example. It is my understanding that Newsday, the Newsday paper out on Long Island in New York, is now running a series of articles describing the importation of heroin from its sources in Turkey in the poppy fields all the way to places on in New York City, and describing the events all the way along the line. Now, that reporter could be called in by a prosecutor who said, this man can break this entire ring. That's an important interest. But I think more important is that the 10 million people in the New York metropolitan area and everyone else in the country be able to have an awareness of whether there's complicity by foreign governments in this process, who's victimized by it, and so forth. So that I think, for most purposes, the trade-off of sacrificing access to the information in order to increase the flow of information to the public is worth it. Let me mention one possible exception. If this committee is going to recommend a bill that lists exceptions, whether they be in terms of categories of crime or in terms of the level of compelling interest or something like that, I think certainly there must be an exception for the criminal defendant in the felony case. When the reporter has highly exculpatory information. And I think that exception is necessary because there you have a clash between two sets of constitutional values. You have those protected by the First Amendment, and then you have the defendant asserting his specific textual right in the Sixth Amendment to the compulsory process for obtaining witnesses. I think in that situation, the defendant's rights might prevail. But I would circumscribe that situation very carefully. I don't think that the situation is quite the same when it's merely when the request for the information is merely premised on the public's right to every man's evidence. But when a defendant asks for it, relying on the Sixth Amendment specifically, then I think in that clash of values, perhaps First Amendment interests can be overwhelmed. Thank you. And now, Mr. Hume.
Mr. Chairman, I had written my statement with the intent of reading it into the record, and unless it will slow things up too much, I'd like to go ahead and do that. It's the only statement that I have. I'm grateful, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to be heard here today. The immediate purpose of the legislation before this subcommittee, as I see it, is to mend the damage done to freedom of the press by the refusal of the Supreme Court to accept the idea that the First Amendment should protect the press's confidential sources of information from identification and grand jury testimony by reporters. There are already numerous examples of the chilling effect which this decision has had both on the press and on its sources of information. I cited some in the article I wrote for the New York Times Magazine on this subject. Other reporters have turned up other examples. The fact that these examples have surfaced at all is an indication of how pervasive is the impact of the court's ruling, for journalists do not normally find out about the stories they don't get. For every visible case of a story that got away because of a reluctant source or a cautious reporter or editor, there must be many others of which we are not aware. As great a problem as grand jury testimony has been for the press, I would hope this subcommittee would be willing to consider the issue of newsmen's privilege in a larger context. As I shall try to demonstrate, grand juries could ultimately prove to be a lesser threat to the confidentiality of reporter sources compared to the threat posed by another form of compulsory testimony. Before going further, I want to say for the record that I favor an absolute privilege for newsmen to protect their sources. I believe it should apply to the states as well as to federal jurisdictions. I recognize, however, that there is probably only the slimmest likelihood that such absolute legislation could be enacted. And one of the exceptions which seems most likely to be included in a newsman's shield law is one which would remove the shield in cases where journalists are sued for libel. Yet this is an issue that seems largely to have been passed over in the discussion of shield legislation so far. Because I have had personal experience with this question, I would like to focus my testimony on it. I believe that if reporters are left without protection for their sources in libel suits, such suits could become a far more dangerous device for the harassment and intimidation of the press and its sources than grand juries could ever be. The reason is that grand juries can only be convened by certain designated officials, while anyone at all can file a libel suit. The first fact which must be understood in dealing with this question is that there isn't much left of civil libel as we once knew it in this country. In a series of decisions dating from the pivotal New York Times versus Sullivan case in 1964, the Supreme Court has drastically narrowed the circumstances under which a newsworthy individual may collect libel damages. The court has held that unless the plaintiff can show that the libel was published with knowledge of its falsity or in reckless disregard of whether it was or not, the First Amendment protects the defendant. At first, the court applied this awesome standard of proof only to persons deemed to be public figures. More recently, however, in the celebrated case of Rosenblum versus Metromedia, it has broadened its application to include, quote, all discussion and communication involving matters of public or general interest without regard to whether the persons involved are famous or anonymous, end quote. The court has also made clear that its idea of reckless disregard of the truth means, quote, there must be sufficient evidence to permit the conclusion that the defendant in fact entertains serious doubts as to the truth of his publication, end quote. Such a standard of proof, applicable to virtually anyone mentioned in a news story, broadcast, or article, would seem to make winning a libel suit against the news media exceedingly difficult. There are many who feel that the court went too far in these decisions and left the individual defenseless against the worst excesses of the press. That is an understandable viewpoint. But it seems to me that the court acted wisely and in harmony with the purpose of the First Amendment. The idea that seems to underlie these decisions is that in a democratic society, where freedom of speech and of the press are both cherished and necessary to the proper function of government, the law must encourage, not discourage, the publication of even the most damaging kind of information about public issues. The kind of information that injures reputations and brings libel suits is often the kind most essential to the public's understanding of the workings of government. Such information, of course, is the hardest of all to get, and those who pursue it face far greater obstacles than their colleagues in the press who cover fires or attend news conferences. The possibility of error is greater. The court has held that because the press is often the only possible source of this vital information, it must be protected in its pursuit of it, so long as it acts in good faith. Until the New York Times versus Sullivan case 9 years ago, the prospect of a libel suit was a powerful deterrent to investigative reporting. Suits were more frequent then, and even when the defendants were clearly right, such suits were often a long and expensive process. Even now, I have found to my dismay that some elements of the media still shy away from hard-hitting reporting, not so much out of fear of losing a libel suit, but out of fear of being sued. Nevertheless, investigative journalism in recent years has been increasingly available. The major magazines are much more receptive to it than they once were. Some publications, such as the Washington Monthly, carry several investigative pieces in nearly every issue. Before its demise last year, a demise that was not brought on by the weight of any libel judgments, Life published a stunning series of reports dealing with political corruption and underworld activity. Book publishers, which formerly shied away from such journalism because of its risks, are now eager to publish investigative work. I think it is beyond question that the American public has had the opportunity to learn many things about government, business, labor, and other major institutions which it would not have had absent the protection for journalists afforded by the Supreme Court rulings I have mentioned. This brightening picture has now been seriously clouded by the questions of whether reporters must reveal their sources when sued for libel. I think I can best illustrate this issue by recounting the circumstances of a suit in which I am personally involved. One of my major undertakings in the past several years has been an investigation of the United Mine Workers of America. My book on the union, Death in the Mines, was published last year. One of the mildest stories I wrote about the union appeared at the end of Jack Anderson's column more than 2 years ago. The item, one paragraph long, raised questions about a burglary at union headquarters. Edward Carey, a union official, sued me, Jack Anderson, and the Washington Post, which carried the column, for a total of $9 million. The suit was filed the very day the story appeared, and he was so eager to take my testimony that he succeeded in getting a court order for me to appear for a deposition 2 days later. The order turned out to be invalid because I had not been served with the papers at the time, but it illustrates what I believe was his haste not to make his case as much as to learn the identity of my sources. Eventually, his lawyer did take my deposition. I was asked to name the source of the part of the story to which Carey objected. It was a sentence that said that he and the since-defeated Union President Tony Boyle had been seen carrying documents out of Boyle's office before Carey reported the burglary. My information had come from an inside source. Tony Boyle's administration had compiled a record for corruption and tyranny perhaps unmatched in the history of the American labor movement. Joseph Yablonsky, the man who challenged Boyle for the union presidency in 1969, was later found murdered in his bedroom along with his wife and daughter. The trail of indictments and convictions in the murders has steadily climbed the ladder of the Boyle regime. It is difficult to imagine circumstances where my determination to protect my sources would be greater. So I refused to name them. Plaintiff Carey then sought an order to compel me to name them. His argument, ironically, was grounded squarely on the New York Times versus Sullivan doctrine. How, he argued, could he prove that I had been reckless or willfully inaccurate if he was not permitted to know where I got my information? He had a point, and the trial judge agreed with him and ordered me to identify my sources. That order is now on appeal. If I lose and still refuse to name my source, I could be held in contempt of court or have a default judgment in Carey's favor entered against me, or both. If I name the source, the suit will end, because there is no evidence that I acted recklessly or with knowledge the story was false. Indeed, I believe firmly it was true and still do. Carey has made no showing that my identification of the sources will lead to evidence of the kind required to win the suit. All he has done is file the papers, deny the truth of the story, and demand to know where I got it. It does not take much imagination to see what might happen if such a procedure were upheld. Since the Supreme Court has seemingly left the issue of newsmen's privilege up to Congress, I think it is quite likely the court might uphold the compulsory identification of news sources in libel suits if Congress specifically refused to make its shield law applicable in this area. Now, there is a plausible point on the other side of this argument. If newsmen had absolute protection against identifying their sources, they could effectively vitiate what is left of the libel laws by hiding behind anonymous sources whenever sued. Nevertheless, I think that the benefits of an absolute shield law would, on balance, still greatly outweigh the disadvantages. I recognize, however, that many members of Congress would not agree with me. I would hope that they, seeing the merit on both sides, might seek a middle course, and I believe that there is such a course. It was charted by the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in a libel suit involving Life magazine and Mayor Alfonso Cervantes of St. Louis. Briefly stated, here is what happened. Life published an investigative article in May 1970 charging that the mayor had maintained what it called, quote, business and personal ties, unquote, to the underworld. Mayor Cervantes sued for libel and focused his complaint on four paragraphs in the article, which he said were both false and defamatory to him. The reporter who did the story was asked in a deposition to name the source of those four paragraphs. He acknowledged that most of the story, including the disputed portion, came from sources inside the FBI, but he refused to name them. The mayor made a motion to compel the testimony. Life responded with a motion for summary judgment, which argued that the mere effort expended in getting the story was sufficient to bring down the curtain of protection afforded by the Times versus Sullivan and succeeding cases. The trial judge ignored the motion to compel testimony and granted Life its motion for summary judgment. Mayor Cervantes appealed. The Federal Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the trial judge. In so doing, the court set forth a standard which it said plaintiffs in libel suits against the news media must meet before gaining access to confidential news sources. The court said, and this is crucial, that, quote, to compel newsmen to breach a confidential relationship merely because a libel suit had been filed against him would seem inevitably to lead to an excessive restraint on the scope of legitimate news-gathering activity, end quote. It also said that, quote, to routinely grant motions seeking compulsory disclosure of anonymous news sources without first inquiring into the substance of a libel allegation would utterly emasculate the fundamental principles that underlay the line of cases articulating the constitutional restrictions to be engrafted upon the enforcement of state libel laws, end quote. Therefore, the court held that there must be what it called a, quote, concrete demonstration that the identity of defense news sources will lead to persuasive evidence, unquote, of willful or reckless error before a libel plaintiff can gain access to confidential sources. Now, this seems to me to be eminently sensible and in keeping with the spirit and intent of the New York Times versus Sullivan and the succeeding decisions. If such a standard were universally established, the filing of frivolous libel suits would not be made attractive, as it is now, by the prospect of learning the identity of reporters' informants. At the same time, however, in extreme cases, the kind of cases envisioned, I think, by the Times versus Sullivan doctrine, the door is left open to the identity of news sources when needed by a clearly wronged plaintiff to make his case. If this subcommittee does not see fit to allow newsmen an absolute privilege to protect their sources, I strongly urge that it consider writing into law the same test for libel suits set forth by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Cervantes case. For if some protection for news sources in libel cases is not forthcoming, the libel suit will again become a powerful instrument in the suppression of a free flow of information to the public. It occurred to me as I sat here this morning, remembering that a year ago at this time, I was testifying before all of you senators as part of the full Judiciary Committee in the ITT affair to mention something about how that whole episode came about, at least as it seemed to me. The central focus of the hearings for much of the time was the so-called Dita Beard Memorandum, which created a great sensation. But I think I can show you that that it was not really the Dita Beard Memorandum which caused the Senate hearings on Mr. Kleindienst's nomination to be reconvened. It was instead the revelation that Mr. Kleindienst had had a series of unpublicized, to say the least, meetings with Felix Rohit and the ITT director, which led ultimately to the settlement of that celebrated antitrust case. At the time that I was following up on the original story that I did for Jack Anderson's column about that memo, I had occasion to talk to a highly regarded former ITT official. He was reluctant to discuss the subject with me, but he was willing to do so once I assured him, and this was all prior to the Caldwell decision, it was about a year ago at this time, that his name would never come out and there was no need for him to worry about the confidentiality of our relationship. And it was he that told me first that these meetings had been held, and it was the first knowledge I had of it. Now, I was able to proceed from there to contact Mr. Rohatyn with a pretty good knowledge of what happened, and he was persuaded to confirm that they occurred. Now, at the time that the story broke, Mr. Kleindienst chose, and Mr. Rohatyn chose, to come before the Judiciary Committee and to plead their case there. But let us suppose that they had taken one or another of some of the other options that might have been open to people in that position. Now, Mr. Kleindienst could have convened a grand jury to investigate the $400,000 alleged contribution to the Republican convention. I could have been called before that grand jury, and a thorough examination could have begun as to how I came about getting that story. Now, at the time, nobody knew whether it was from an ITT official or a government official or from whom that I got my first tip. but it would have certainly opened the door to the identification of that source. It would have opened the door to the punishment of that source, either by ITT, if he had still been with ITT, or by the government, had the person still been involved in government. Another option open to both Mr. Kleindienst and Mr. Roatan would have been to file a libel suit against me and to seek the identity of my source in that way, and thereby seek to close off the leak. So I think that is a case that all of you are quite familiar with, which illustrates just exactly the kinds of things that can happen when the door is wide open to reporter sources. And I know that perhaps you, Senator Gurney, might feel that the ITT hearings were long and drawn out and perhaps unnecessary, but I think that I have no doubt that you would feel that it was probably good that the facts came out and were thoroughly explored and that the public learned of them. And I feel that the kind of chilling effect that might result from having the door wide open to newsmen sources could well have prevented that story as it has prevented others.
But you've given us a most illuminating statement and the benefit of your personal experiences in this field. I think I would take it that you agree fully with what Mr. Jack Kilpatrick said yesterday, that corruption, he was thinking about corruption in government, but the same thing as your statement shows would exist in business and also in labor. Or any kind of a big organization.
Major institution.
That the only way, the only practical way by which the public can get information of corruption, either in government or in business or in labor or in any other activity which bears so much on the interests of the public, is through investigative reporters having inside informants within those organizations.
Well, Senator Ervin, inside informants are not always the source of all of the information, but so often they're the ones that get you started on a story. They give you the first look, the first glimpse of what may be there, and without them, really, an investigative reporter is at a loss as to where to look. There's so much of... So many things that ought to be uncovered, but you have to know where to start. And this is where inside sources are terribly important and I think indispensable.
Because it's obvious that those in charge, those in government who are engaging in corrupt practices, or those in business who are engaged in corrupt practices, or those in labor who engage in corrupt practices, and who control the organizations, they're certainly not going to publicize their own misdeeds.
That's right. You can't get started like
and,
that.
And normally, all too often, the only people who have knowledge of those things are those who are inside the organization and who are shocked by what comes to their notice in the field in corruption.
That's certainly correct. The important thing about inside sources is that... Must be recognized that they're often the only possible sources for
yes.
this kind of information.
And even the government itself and the law enforcement organizations recognize this fact because they often have some agents, undercover agents, infiltrate organizations, find out what's going on in them. So the government recognizes it's the same as an investigative reporter or anyone who observes what goes on in our world. You've made a very helpful contribution, and I think your testimony shows that this committee ought to give serious consideration to the questions which arise in this area in the field of libel.
Chairman, I was interested in what both witnesses have testified to, particularly the personal experiences of Mr. Hume. Mr. Hume, in your experience, has there been more news management by government, say, in the last 20 years?
Well, I've only been a reporter for just under 10 years, so I can't speak with any real authority about what occurred before then, but I think that certainly there is an increasing... effort on the part of those in power to control what the press has to say about them. And I think that that is just, I mean, I think that the government's attempt to subpoena newsmen and its continuing, the continuing vendetta that seems to be in progress by the present administration against the press is just one manifestation of that. I think, though, that this administration is not alone in that. I think that earlier administrations did the same thing. And I think that it's really inevitable that, that people in power will try to do this. I don't think there's any way to stop them from trying to do it. I think that it's that's the way it has always been in one way or another, and that's the way it always will be. And, but the only thing you can really do about it is to try to make the press immune, at least from having any legal, from the government having any legal authority over the content of the news. And I think that as Charles Rembar, the lawyer who has done so much in this area of the First Amendment, has observed, what we're seeing now is not an attack on the principle that there ought to be freedom of the press. Everybody agrees there ought to be freedom of the press. What we're seeing now is an attempt to take away the tools by which freedom of the press is exercised. And, of course, inside sources are absolutely vital to the most crucial kind of information.
Well, I heard you say that there has been more investigative reporting in the last few years than formerly, and that magazines and newspapers and book companies are more prepared to publish a reporter's hard-hitting investigation than formerly. That's...
Yeah, I think there's no question about it. I think that the people at the White House would probably think that's because the press is out to get them, but I think that it started well before that. I think that the freedom accorded by the Times versus Sullivan doctrine is opened the door. And you see investigative reporting in places where you didn't used to see it so much. Harper's and the Atlantic are receptive to this kind of thing. Book publishers are. I found, it used to be that reporters who were involved in this thing had a terrible time getting books published. And now now they're being receiving plenty of attention and good advances, and the books are doing well. Investigative reporting, or muckraking, as it is often called, is in kind of a renaissance. But I think it's a renaissance born not of any particular fashion. It's born of the freedom that has been accorded by the Supreme Court's attitude toward this issue of libel and other issues. Now, I'm afraid that the tide may be turning, and that's why we're here.
Well, one of the things that impresses me is when you have a situation where government, this is not a partisan matter because it's Democratic and Republican administrations, where government is doing more and more to control news, there is an increasing need for investigative reporting to try and establish the truth of what is actually being given out by the government as factual. And I think that that one of the reasons for investigative reporting is not more of it is not only the Sullivan case, but also because there's more news management by government.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And I couldn't agree with you more that in this area that newsmen have got to be protected, because I think that the only way that you can pierce the veil of government secrecy and news management is to give an investigative reporter an opportunity to get confidential tips so that those confidential tips can then develop into a story which would inform the public as to what the truth is.
Yeah, I think this point ought to be made in that connection, Senator Toney, and it's simply this, that the government, and especially the president, has a platform from which he can reach an enormous amount of the American public at any time he wants to, for as long as he wants to. He can get on television, he can say whatever he wants for as long as he wants. Now, no one questions the need for this. Obviously, the president ought to be able to communicate with the public. And I cite the president because it's the best example. There are many other examples of people in power being able to reach reach the electorate. But the point is that this unparalleled, unprecedented opportunity to communicate with the public is also an unparalleled and unprecedented opportunity to propagandize the public. And I think that if you consider what is spent every day in Washington, the amount of time and paper that is spent on press releases and the government's rosy version of how well everything is going, what a good job everybody is doing in all branches of the government, I think the press begins to look like an institution that is somewhat overwhelmed. And all it can really hope to do, it seems to me, is to provide some antidote to the massive doses of propaganda which are coming at it from all sides. And I think this is where investigative reporting is critical.
Well, I agree with you.
Mr. Gore, let me pose one question to you here. Let's assume that the matter of the civil liberties of a defendant in a criminal trial are involved. Perhaps he's accused of some sort of conspiracy to commit a crime in connection with a Black Panther meeting, to use the investigative reporter matter in the Caldwell case. And let's assume there's a pretty good case against him. And further assume that perhaps an investigative reporter has a pretty good piece of evidence that might be very vital to his defense, which he got through confidential sources. What would be your recommendation to the committee in a case like that?
Well, Senator Gurney, as I indicated in my opening remarks, let me just back up a second. I don't think that case arises very often. It's hard to document, but I would be surprised to find that there were very many instances where the reporter had confidential information, highly exculpatory, that really he knew that the defendant didn't do it, somebody else did. And the reporter was the only person that had that information. If those three kinds of conditions coalesce, then, as I said, I think you have a clear clash between Sixth and First Amendment rights, and I think you resolve that clash, that particular clash, and only that clash, in the criminal context, in favor of the defendant's rights. We make it seem as though providing a privilege not to reveal information is something unusual, that reporters are the only ones who are asking for it. If someone comes into my office and I'm an attorney and confesses to me that he committed a crime, I have a privilege, I would assume, not to reveal that information. That certainly impedes the flow of information, and that's highly relevant evidence, but we accept that because of the interests involved, because it's more important, we feel, that attorneys be able to advise their clients fully and that those clients be able to confer with their attorneys fully than it is that a particular client be convicted if, in fact, he's guilty. And the other thing is our system, and I think properly so, is more concerned with an innocent man being convicted than it is with a guilty man going free. Most of the procedural safeguards in the Bill of Rights recognize that kind of distinction, and I think it's been suggested in a lot of Supreme Court cases and other places that better to have one guilty man go free, one innocent man go to jail. So that I think that those kinds of exceptions, when you have this clash of interests, are recognized by the Bill of Rights, are part of our sense of justice, and it doesn't trouble me. Now, I think...
Well, you would recommend that exception.
Well, as I said, I think that if you're going to write exceptions, that's one that certainly has to go in, and I think that's...
Because some of the bills, of course, before us say there shall be no exceptions.
I understand that. I think, in part, it depends on your weighing of how often that's going to come up. I'm not sure it comes up that often. You know, there are hard cases, and as you're more aware than anyone else, it's hard to envision every single case when you're trying to write general legislation. I think, though, that it would be foolish to write an exception for a hard case that rarely comes up. And I think that's one of those hard cases. If there are going to be exceptions, I think that's going to be one of them. But I'm not sure that the evidence shows that situation comes up often enough to allow a written exception into a statute.
You're saying that you are not recommending it.
Now, what I'm saying is this. I think it's important to determine from these hearings how often that situation comes up. I don't think it comes up very often. I think it's your judgment whether it comes up often enough to provide an exception for it. But I would certainly think if you're going to be providing Once you start opening the door to exceptions, and many of these bills have those, then I think it would be remiss not to include a specific one here where the person seeking the information relies on a specific constitutional provision. That's what I'm saying. I mean, I think it's difficult to say absolute or not. I'm saying it part depends on what you find here. If it's a problem, I think there ought to be an exception. If you're going to write exceptions, this certainly ought to be one of them. And finally, I would think that same thing in the libel situation. If you're going to write one, and most of these bills have one, the Cervantes case that Senator Eaglin mentioned, that Mr. Hume mentioned, is an important minimum rule, and I would think the rule of that case has to be part of any exception in a libel context. And so far as I know, none of the bills that I've seen do that. They just simply say in a libel sense.
Mr. Kilpatrick testified before the committee yesterday, and he gave some very interesting testimony. The essence of it was that we really shouldn't do anything about legislation for two reasons, as I understood his testimony. One was that if we did, then we really do weaken the First Amendment because we say, well, the First Amendment really doesn't mean what it says, and so we've got to try to correct it with legislation. Therefore, we cut it down and weaken it, and there's much argument in that idea. But the other point he made, though, and this is really why I brought it up, because of your mention of these two other cases here, it was that while he thought that the Caldwell case was most unfortunate, disagreed with it, he felt that the courts themselves would probably correct this in point of time. And, of course, these cases that you mention here, I think, are a nibbling into the Caldwell case and a clarification of it. What would you say about that idea?
Let me respond to your first question about the appropriateness of legislation in this area. As I recall the text of the First Amendment, it does not say that Congress shall make no law respecting freedom of the press. It says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press. I think that's an important distinction. I think Congress can certainly legislate in a way that protects and advances freedom of the press, consistently with the text of the Now, as to whether the courts can fill the breach, that's hard to predict. After all, the Second Circuit decision in the Baker case, which is referred to in my testimony, and which is a very eloquent decision by Judge Kaufman of the United States Court of Appeals, came up in the context of a civil action, not criminal, where the plaintiffs wanted information from a journalist, and where there was really not a strong showing that that information was particularly vital to the plaintiff's case. I think that would have been, I would be willing to guess that the Supreme Court that decided Brandsburg would have reached the same result as the Second Circuit did in Baker. That's not a particularly hard case. So while it's encouraging that that precedent is there and that the Cervantes case has limited the situation in the libel context, I'm not sure that we can confidently predict that the courts will be sufficiently responsive so that it obviates the need for legislation. However, I would say that a very weak federal bill, either weak in its procedural provisions or weak in its substance, if I had to choose between that and taking my chances with the federal courts, I think I would prefer the latter approach. It's hard to make a fast judgment on that. Lawyers can distinguish the Brandsburg case by saying, well, that involved a grand jury. And every other situation is up for grabs. It depends on the inclination of courts, the lower federal courts, to deal with arguments based on those distinctions. But I think today, until we have some cases which protect information in a hard context, where it's a difficult situation and they're making a choice between a DA's claim for the information and a reporter's claim, until we see some of those, I think that the Congress now is the appropriate forum to remedy the situation.
Let me pose this final question to you. Suppose we're faced with a situation where the only kind of shield law you're going to get is one that does have a number of exceptions to it, and some members of Congress feel that that may be the case, that it's not possible to have a total shield law. Do you think it would be better to not have any law at all rather than one that had several exceptions?
Well, Senator, it really is hard to answer that question blind. As I was saying in response to Senator Tunney's remark earlier, if a bill did nothing more than require that no subpoena could be issued except by court order after a hearing, if that procedural protection were in a bill, then even if you had relatively mild substantive provisions, compelling interest for the information, let's say, the mildest of the substantive provisions I've seen in those bills, I think that would still be an advance. I think a bill like that would be worthwhile. If you only have moderate procedural protections and you only have a moderate substantive definition, or you have lots of qualifications, then I think I'd probably take my chances with the courts. So I think it depends on what kind of bill, what protections, what procedures, what substance. The bill Senator Eagleton discussed it earlier this morning, I think it's very helpful. It makes distinctions in terms of the flow of information, confidential versus public out on the street. For example, if the bill provided absolute protection, if the Eagleton-type approach were adopted by the Congress, I think that'd be a healthy approach. I think it would protect the core of the reporter's function and without resolving some of these fringe issues, the reporter who happens to fortuitously witness a crime on the street. So I think the answer to your question is that it really does depend on what the final bill provided.
Thank you.
Chairman, I just had one observation. I think that it's rather fascinating that at a time that we see an increasing desire by government to cut back on the ability of a newsman to protect his sources, we see an increasing use by government of the doctrine of executive privilege to save the government the embarrassment of having its high officials testify as to what is going on in their departments. And it's an interesting cross-ruffle that is taking place, and it seems to me to demonstrate once again the fact that government is doing everything that it can to try and manage news and to try and have the public accept as factual only that which the government desires to have disseminated.
Well, that is, I think, an attribute of government. In other words, I find that so many government officials think that freedom of the press should be free to praise them, but not to censure. And that's quite a human reaction, I think.
Very human, but I don't think very good for a democracy.
Oh, no.
I can't help but observe that I think some of the executive privilege that's been exercised recently has to do with politics and really not government. I think if the Congress were a Republican Congress, we might not have some of the problems we have. I refer back to the ITT hearings that Mr. Hume brought up, and I think there was a pretty full disclosure by a whole lot of people on the part of the executive branch of government about what went on. There was no reluctance to testify there in that very crucial hearing and make sure that we had the full benefit of all the information we could.
Well, I think government comes out of politics, and I'm for the freest and fullest discussion in both government and politics. I don't think you have good government unless you have a lot of political talk.
Depends on whose ox is being gored.
Well, the ox that's being gored doesn't appreciate being gored. That's undoubtedly true. Thank you, gentlemen. You've given us a most interesting discussion.